Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Lauren Gunderson. The prolific writer is, after Shakespeare, the most produced playwright in the country this year, 2019, according to the annual survey conducted by American Theatre Magazine. It's the second time she's at the top of that list, and when she's not at the top, she's usually somewhere not much farther down. But if you live in New York City, there's a decent chance you've never seen a play by Lauren Gunderson, because while her work is performed all over the country, she's carved out her impressive career largely without New York, where productions of her work are rare. But this winter, New Yorkers have the chance to check out Gunderson's work with The Half-Life of Marie Curie, now playing off-Broadway in a production that stars Kate Mulgrew and Francesca Faridani, and produced by Audible, which will also release an audio adaptation of the play on its audiobook platform. Gunderson's in the studio with me to talk science, Jane Austen, Shakespeare, and how she's proving that New York isn't the only place to be a successful playwright. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much. What fun.
So tell me, what is the official count of the number of plays you have written? Because you have many, many under your belt at this point.
I don't actually know. I think it's probably two-ish dozen.
That's what it seems like. It's more than 20 appears to be definite.
I think and that then, is correct.
Right.
I should know a solid answer to that,
yeah.
But I don't.
You must write very fast. How do you do that? Is that through a schedule? Is that through a...
Yeah.
Do you have like a word count per day or something?
No,
or,
I don't really keep track of it like that. I mean, what do I do? I get up as early as I can. Mm. And I work really hard for the first couple hours of the day. And I think after like 1 or 2 p.m., I'm a little useless.
Right.
But, you know, it's all problem solving for me. So it's seeking out the corner of the story or the massive chunk, depending on the play and the problem of the play.
Right.
And really trying to like to hone in. And once I hone in, I can focus on that problem. And I tend to solve it pretty quickly. But that's kind of the general churn of the writing.
Yeah, and also part of that churn is just the number of ideas you seem to have.
Yeah.
Where do you have a standard answer for where you get your ideas and where they come from?
I mean, it depends on the kind of category of show. I write a lot of history, a lot of science history, a lot of feminist history, and there is really no end to those amazing, undiscovered parts of history that I would love to see on stage and see be brought to life. So this is why it's almost dangerous for me to read biographies, because it's two pages in and I think, oh my God, this is a play. But yes, and then sometimes it's, everything, lines that I overhear in the subway or amazing pieces of art or music, or sometimes it's a feeling that I haven't seen that feeling put on stage, or a complex kind of a person with some complexity in a person or a time or whatever.
Is there a play that you've, can you name one of your plays that was inspired by a feeling?
Yeah, so my play Exit Pursued by a Bear, which is a couple years old now, is this combination of rage and devotion. It's about a domestic abuse survivor who is ridding herself of her husband finally with the help of this elaborate, strange, farcical plot with her two best friends, one of whom is a stripper, set in North Georgia, where I'm from Georgia. Oh. So it was this weird, and I knew the tone of the play was going to be weird, but it was trying to, what is that thing where you love what you hate and you need what you don't want, and you are braving that with courage enough to save yourself. So it came out of that.
A lot of your plays have, or a number anyway, have had sort of rolling premieres through the National New Play Network, so you get to see them like three separate times. How much of watching the play with an audience through that process influences the kind of work you do on the play as it goes along?
Yeah, a lot of it still is my own barometer. I think if I hear an audience reaction in one place and I change it and hear another and it's different, and the only thing I know is my aesthetic and my sense of what's funny and what's good and what's meaningful. So I try to kind of, you know, of course you are moved by the reactions around you, but I try to average it out and mostly use myself as a guidepost. But I will say I love NNPN so much. I think it's the best idea in the last couple decades in American theater because of what it gives writers.
Yeah. What is your aesthetic? You just mentioned your aesthetic. Do you have can you characterize it?
Yeah. again, a little bit depends on the play because it does kind of morph and shift where I'm writing a farce or a historical drama or something contemporary. But I think it is brainy people with great passion. Both of those adjectives means that they go fast, think fast, decide fast, face consequences fast. So there is an energy, a pace that you just hopefully can't look away from because of what's next, what are they gonna do, what will become of them. And that's combined with a lot of humor and a lot of kind of wackiness. people that have, I don't know, that people that like laugh at their own jokes. I think that maybe my own personal aesthetic for my life and also, of course, plays into my plays, so yes. Right. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Something like that.
And you started to sort of allude to this. A lot of your plays deal with people who are scientists, and they talk sort of science themes. Like you seem to love science. Has that always been true? And at what point did you realize that science and playwriting weren't diametrically opposed and could
be
together?
I mean, honestly, I learned that super early. It's one of the reasons why I think I wanted to write plays was actually science. Hmm. Part of which is Copenhagen and Arcadia, both of those things. when I was kind of young in theater, but knew I really wanted to do it and was starting to investigate, what is this thing?
How do you do it well? What part in your development was this? Was this high school?
High school, I luckily learned pretty early that I loved theater. I mean, this was in kindergarten when I knew I loved it. I didn't know exactly that I wanted to be a writer until a couple of years later, but still that's middle school. So how lucky am I to know early enough that I want to do this? Yeah. And so in high school, and I was really kind of exploring the world of wordcraft, those plays were very popular. So it gave me a big old spotlight on, yes, you can write fiercely intelligent people and things and be creative structurally, and all that stuff that still marks my work now. But I will say, when I was in high school, I knew I wanted to write, but I didn't know about what would you want to write.
Yeah.
I'm no one that's particularly special. So I don't have this, you know, life story that's traumatic and needs to be on stage. So as soon as I discovered the stories of science and the stories of history, I thought, well, there you go, that's drama. And science in particular, more than just general history, because it has this human-sized moment where everything changes. And that, to me, is the crux of the most gripping moments in theater, is where with some decision, some one action that is human-sized, things change. And we get to be in the room with them as they have these ideas or this proof is realized, or, you know, the bravery of a new experiment is started. So I've always loved it.
And how often do you think about, you've said in interviews, you've talked about a couple of your plays draw on Jane Austen and Christmas, which A, sounds really fun, and B, sounds like the savviest sort of sales move, because everybody loves Jane Austen. Every theater needs a new Christmas play because they're tired of Christmas Carol. Like, how much does that sort of, your understanding of what theaters want, what audiences want, play into the kinds of subjects you explore and write about?
Yeah, the Miss Bennet plays were particularly an answer to a question that every theater asks itself.
Yeah.
And my writing partner, Margot Melkon, worked on kind of the other side. She was a literary manager and literary dramaturg. And so worked with me on a lot of plays before we started writing together. And then it was in a conversation as we were driving up to actually Ashland, Oregon Shakespeare Theater Festival.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, of course. And had this conversation about like, God, I'm so tired.
From San Francisco. How long of a drive is that?
It's like, it's five and a half hours.
Oh, okay. That's not terrible.
Maybe six and a half. Anyway. Somebody's going to correct me. Anyway, yeah. Yes, long enough where we had to like, we could have some long conversations. And we posed ourselves this question. And Margot was like, what about Jane Austen? And I was like, that's a great idea. I wonder what we could do. Well, you know, the other sisters don't get much play in the books. Oh my God, there's so many sisters.
There are a lot of sisters, right?
Man. Yeah. And then it was what you exactly said at the beginning, which is it's a lot of fun. It's a play it's a very welcoming play. So everybody.
Now the first play is called
Miss Bennet.
The second one is called Christmas at Pemberley? No.
It is Miss Bennet, Christmas at Pemberley.
Okay, great.
And then the second is the Wickhams, Christmas at Pemberley.
We have
a theme. So many Christmases, so much Pemberley.
Yeah, okay.
we kind of reversed engineered a show that we wish we'd had growing up, and one that can put, frankly, a hell of a lot of women on stage. We insist that directors and casting directors focus on a diversity and an inclusive cast, so it's not just the British white people parade, which is made for the most warm feelings when it's about this time when these plays start being launched. The Wickhams just launched in Chicago at Northlight, so we get to see these just array of photos of the most wonderful actors all across the country, and every year it's kind of my Christmas present.
Right.
These photos of all these beautiful women in beautiful costumes, and they're all there together. That show has been, I think, understandably successful because people are looking for something that has intelligence and heart, but is welcoming enough for audiences that you can do year and year again. And we're starting to see theaters now do Miss Bennet more than once, and then now we have Wickhams, and then we're writing a third one that will complete our trilogy.
The trilogy, yeah. Let's talk about the reason you are here in New York from San Francisco, the Half-Life of Marie Curie, which is having its world premiere at the Minetta Lane Theater.
Indeed.
Tell me, where'd the idea for that come from? That was a commission from Audible, the producer,
that
you told me.
Yeah, I mean, I write a lot about science and women and history, and everyone kind of goes, where's your Marie Curie play? And I thought,
fair enough, yeah.
The only female scientist people actually know by name is her. So, but it felt a little too obvious, but the truth was I didn't have a way in, because she felt cold and distant and unemotional and uncomplicated. And then, of course, like a dummy, I just didn't read enough about her. And then diving in, the complexity of her life.
What prompted you to dive in?
So actually it was a Google Doodle. You know when you go to Google for their page and they have little doodles, their little pictures, and you click and it'll tell you what the heck that day was in history that was of interest. One of them was of Hertha Ayrton.
Okay.
Didn't know who she was.
Yes. But she is the other character in the Half-Life of Marie Curie.
She's indeed.
Also a woman I'd never heard of until last night.
Yes. Most people haven't.
Yeah.
In the little doodle, it looked like she was doing some manner of science. Mm. And I thought, I don't know who that is. I know all the lady scientists, don't I? And so I just did a few clicks and found this incredible woman, British scientist, won the Hughes Medal, was an engineer, and all these very interesting things. Was a fierce suffragist at that time. This is, turn of the century. And this one little footnote mentioned her devoted friendship with Marie Curie. And I thought, So here we go. Now we have a very famous scientist and an unknown scientist who had a female friendship, a mature female friendship. Both of them had daughters. Both of them were, of course, had survived various versions of sexism and bias, of course, that we still go through now. And, the real crux of the play started with what do we not expect Marie Curie? In what state do we not expect her to be when we meet her? And the answer was the state of Monica Lewinsky. Because truly, this moment in her time and time that the play is about, we find her in the middle of a sex scandal. Marie Curie?
Yeah.
What? I'm sorry. But, yeah. So it was the most interesting thing to read, and then to see that her friend Hertha basically saved her life by saying, you know, let's get you out of France. The press is being horrible to her, following her around, following her children around, writing the most terrible racist things about her, sexist things, of course, all of this stuff about her. And we find her at this lowest point, and her friend is there to say, get out of here, come with me, just come. And so the true history is she kind of steals Marie Curie across the English Channel using a pseudonym, and like, you know, it's very kind of spy versus spy. And it truly is a story that has become about two women. And there's not a romance between them. It's not, the other doesn't need something from the, you know, it's literally about how we save ourselves, how friends save us. So, yeah.
And at what point did Audible get involved? Had you had that idea before Audible started talking to you? Because this is part of a program that we should say Audible,
yes.
You know, is producing plays that they are then recording for and releasing as, I mean, audiobooks? What will you call it when it?
Yeah, it's
do
like
you call an, it an audiobook, an audio
it's
drama?
Kind of like a radio
an audio,
play.
Yeah,
audio
uh-huh.
drama,
yeah.
radio play. And of course, the British are very familiar with radio plays and
right.
radio dramas.
Yeah.
We are not
no.
over here. But that is a form that they know very well. And so it's quite interesting to think about how it would change things for me. And I actually do think that the Audible Commission program is pretty fascinating, because if I were a kid, I grew up in right outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Not the biggest theater town in the world, but I was so thirsty, as I mentioned, reading Copenhagen and Arcadia. And this program would have, I think, changed the course of my career, because
yeah.
I would have been able to experience new plays in New York. I didn't go to New York till I was 16 or 17.
Yeah.
So as a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, I could have listened to these plays. So in that way, it kind of warms my heart a little bit to be involved in this project. Would have meant a lot to me as a kid.
Did the fact that it is being recorded as an audio drama influence the way you conceived the play and what happened on stage?
Yes, yeah. I realized very quickly that what I love most about theater are the silent moments.
Mm-hmm.
the glances and the urges, right. but you can't say anything, mm-hmm. and what you're trying to hold back. And a lot of that, I thought, was not gonna work for a radio play. But in fact, you realize how much substance there is in silence. You can actually convey a lot. But it also meant that when we were given the opportunity to stage it in this beautiful production, we could, there's things on stage that you won't totally get in the radio right. version, or the audible version, that you get to see in the play. And so I kind of like that it is a different play than it is an audio play, but it is also the same.
And it will not be recorded with an audience, is that right?
No.
Yeah, right.
They recorded
okay.
it in the booth.
In the studio, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, I will, to answer your earlier question, the idea, I'd been thinking about this, but it really was there. I gave them a couple of ideas, and this is the one that they said immediately, that one, that's the one we want. I can't wait. Write it right now.
Right. Yeah.
But it, as all plays do, took the pitch worked, but
yeah.
the play is different. And so
right.
I just spent a lot.
How long does it take for you to write a play?
About a year.
Okay.
And that is...
How many plays are you working on at the same time?
A lot. I mean, it depends. I mean, I can't work on new plays at the same time, like three new plays at
sure.
the same.
Yeah, that makes
but
sense.
As long as they're
yeah.
in different phases. One
uh-huh.
that's on draft three, one that's very early and I'm just kind of trying to figure out how to talk about it. One that's, I'm fixing typos and
okay.
doing rewrites for production. So, you know, as long as they're staggered, I can kind of keep things in my mind.
Right. And this one is having its world premiere here in New York at the Minetta Lane. What's that like for you? We have not seen a lot of your plays here in New York.
And I know.
So this is, tell me about sort of what's it like to sort
it's
of
It's awesome.
It. Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. This company has the right people with the right passion for theater, the right aesthetic, and frankly, the right resources to do a really kick-ass job. I mean, yeah. Rachel Hawk was doing our set.
Right.
And GT Upchurch is directing, and the design team, the actors, Kate Mulgrew mm-hmm. and Francesca
yeah.
Ferradani, are works of art.
Both,
I mean, they're
both excellent. Yeah.
They're
mm-hmm.
both powerhouses.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's writing a play that requires the best of everything, and they're a company that can give you the best of everything. And they really believe in it. And I think they're a bit disruptive, because they're just kind of like, no, we're just going to make theater how we do it, which is
yeah.
we commission and we bring people in and we produce it and we record
and
it, and that's how we do it.
Right. Yeah.
So there's a kind of really interesting attack on theater that I really like. So
have New York audiences struck you as at all different from?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's audiences or the people choosing the plays. Or, mm-hmm. I mean, both. They're obviously talking to one another. But I will say, I find I don't see a lot of history plays in New York that aren't musicals. You know, Doll's House 2 being an exception. Right. But most of the time, it's contemporary or big musicals. And I, of course, love to write a history play more than anything. That's been a really interesting thing, a slight intimidation, because I'm bringing a history play to a city that doesn't do them very much. Right. So I hope that what people see in our show has a contemporary feel. It's fast, it's juicy, it's emotional, it's kind of nonstop. But they are 100 years ago, and I kind of love that. And the truth is, the whole point of the play is it's the same sexism, the same hard work, the same bias in science, the same politics as now. So we kind of really, I think GT directed the play with that kind of nonstop fierceness for that reason.
Right. There, for... I might argue to say most people, there is this sort of conventional wisdom of, you know, how to be a successful playwright. And that involves you live in New York and your first play gets done at, you know, I don't know, a nonprofit, one of the nonprofits. And then it sort of trickles out around the country from there. And then and I feel like everyone in New York sort of believes that. And you went to NYU for grad school, right? Mm-hmm. You studied playwriting at NYU. Yep. I feel like all your classmates, and probably you yourself believed that at the time, right?
Yes.
Like, when did you start to think, to realize that, oh, wait, that's not the only way that this can happen?
Yeah, I don't know. There was no grand plan for me. It was saying yes to crazy things that happened as they happened.
And how did you end up in San Francisco? You've been in San Francisco for a while now.
Yes, I said yes to a crazy thing.
And that was it? Okay, yeah.
Basically, I was kind of being driven west anyway. I worked a lot with South Coast Rep, and Oregon Shakes is out there, and Marin Theater Company. And so Marin invited me out after graduating from NYU. I had kind of a summer that included Timothy O'Neill and a couple of different residencies and things, and the last one was in San Francisco. And man, it's a gorgeous city. And what a cool town, full of amazing people, strange, complex politics.
It should also be said that it's not like you chose a city that's cheaper to live in than New York, right? Because I think San Francisco might be more expensive.
It was a sidestep. It was not.
Basically a sidestep. That's right.
I think we compete for the most expensive city.
I think that's right,
But it's such an interesting thing because it feels more like Paris than New York, just the vibe of it, the look of the city. And I liked that. And I met who's now my husband, and I found an incredible community of theaters who want to produce plays, not just work on them. And so I mean, in 1 year, I've been there a couple years, three years or so, and I had 5 world premieres in 1 year.
That's astonishing.
In San Francisco, in one city.
Right.
What?
Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Wait, what? I almost don't want to say that because everyone's going to be like, oh, I'm sorry, is that how it works in San Francisco? Yeah. Let's all move there. And it was amazing. And it was, they were all very different plays at very different companies. And a city that can sustain that.
Right. And so is this all over? This is in San Francisco itself. And then you said Marin. And then there are a number of theaters south of the city as well, right?
Yeah, TheaterWorks in Palo Alto. And of course, Berkeley Rep.
Right.
And, you know, it is a deep community of artists. And what I do love is we have some of my favorite theaters are like Crowded Fire Theater, which is small, new, diverse, has a real kind of punk rock theater aesthetic, and San Francisco Playhouse, which is, you know, will do some stuff that New York has done, but now commissions a lot of new plays, and they do musicals as well. And Marin Theater Company is kind of on the edge of new playwriting and new playwrights. And so it's a fascinating town. So again, there was no grand plan.
Right.
It was kind of a beautiful accident.
But so you moved there right after NYU,
right after NYU, and found myself in this.
And writing a ton of plays because you,
Yeah, writing a lot of plays, and then people said yes to them, and then suddenly people were doing them. I don't know, it's crazy.
Right, yeah.
Which of course makes me want to write more plays, and then honestly, it's the thirst for being in the room. It's that first week or two of rehearsal on a new play where it is so collaborative and so generative and so iterative, and we're all just making this thing together. And that feeling of making a thing with people you respect is addictive, and I kind of am always craving that. So all of this work and the fastness of the process and the amount of ideas, I think, is all in some ways serving getting me back in that room.
Right, yeah. And I imagine you must get a lot of questions from young aspiring playwrights who look at the amount of work you do and the amount of opportunity you have and just say, how did you do it? What is the advice that you tend to give an emerging playwright?
It is advice that I got. One is that writers write. So instead of thinking about writing or planning your writing or talking about how you one day will write. Yeah. And that, however you need to do that.
Who told you that?
One of my mentors, Jim Grimsley, who's an amazing writer and novelist at Emory University. Mm. So another Atlanta, Georgia boy.
And you went to college and you went to undergrad.
I went to undergrad at Emory. Writers write. So that is, what that means is get up every day and do it. You can write every day. If it sucks, delete it. Right. if you don't want anyone to see it, scratch it out.
Yeah.
But you can, and also what it makes you do is ask yourself, what should I write today? What is, if I'm feeling blocked, if I'm feeling like I don't know what to do, what's the way around it? And sometimes it's writing something else. Sometimes it's saying, let me just write a monologue for no reason about one of the minor characters in this play. And I bet that will unlock something, maybe make a whole new play. And the other thing is see as much theater as you can. Read as much theater as you can. Talk to people about it. Find what you like about it. And you don't have to find what other people like about it. You can say, I like it. And the more you know what you like, then you can write what you like. And the real secret is make plays that you want to see.
Right.
And then you're always going to be on the right, doing the thing you love on the right side of your own heart. And they may be deeply commercially obvious, and they may be totally obscure and strange, but you will love them. You want them to exist in the world. So as long as that's your guidepost, it should be fun to write. I think my most guilty thing that I say is that I actually really like writing. Mm-hmm. I like the process of it. I like the puzzle solving of it. I like the mysteries unlocked. Fixing a thing, building a thing, I love that feeling, actually. So I'm not one of those writers that likes to have written. I kind of love it. Like, give me a problem. Let's figure this out. Why is that not funny? Why is this not moving? Why? That's just too long. Let's cut. What can we cut? How do we do it? The engineering and architecture of storytelling to me is just liberating and exciting and oof. Talk about it all day.
Is there a thing that you know now that you wish you knew back when you were starting out?
Mm-hmm. Dramatic structure.
Which is a thing you taught yourself by doing it over and over again? Or how did you learn? How did you come to learn it?
Yes, by not doing it well or not knowing that I didn't know it. So when I went to NYU and my great friend and the amazing playwright and screenwriter and TV writer, Steve Yockey, who is basically my brother, he and I lived together here, and he was one who encouraged me. He went to NYU a year before me, but we know each other from Atlanta. And he was like, dramatic structure, girl, I just learned it. This is amazing. This is the secret to all the things. And I was like, what are you talking about? So learning, and the beginning, middle, end of things. And it can sound a little anti-art sometimes because it sounds formulaic. It sounds like you just show up and, put in words to a form that already exists. And of course, that's not it. But what it asks you to do is to be always aware that you are creating a journey. And the journey isn't just go to the store, come home. It is the ups and downs. It's crafting that rise and the fall and earning and knowing that you're doing it. So it's not an accident that we get to the end and we care what Hamlet does in that last moment. It's not an accident. There's purpose to those decisions, purpose to when he does this and why he does this and how it causes this and how it is inevitable that we end up in that sword fight. And I think that inevitability is the engineering of a good story.
I feel like the speed with which you write would make you a good candidate for TV writing because they need a lot of writing really fast.
They do.
And often rewriting really fast too. Is that a thing you are interested in exploring or have explored?
Yeah, I mean, I've explored a little bit. It's kind of right project, right time, you know? And because I don't live in either New York or LA, it's a big commitment to move. But I have written on a couple features and do more screenwriting because it's less about the room and more about the project.
Right.
But I think I'll definitely do it at some point. Yeah. And I'm sure it will be fun and crazy making all of our forms are.
Yeah. What other plays are you working on right now?
So I have an adaptation of a big old progressive, anti-colonial, anti-sexist Peter Pan, which they're doing at Shakespeare Theater Company, which is the big theater in D.C. Yeah. So it's a real fun one to take on a mythology that is very complex and does not hold up well now and say, well, what about it is worth saving and is worth bringing to a new generation? And how can we take that as an opportunity to say, let's talk about these indigenous stereotypes. Let's talk about the roles of women in the show and really do something new and exciting with it, but knowing that people will come and see it. So in some ways, taking the strategy of doing Peter Pan and turning it into a kind of activism almost. Like, people are going to come see Peter Pan because it says Peter Pan, but when they get there, they are going to find a story about women with agency and an indigenous character that has fierce intelligence and schools everybody there about what that life is like. There's so many things going on right now. There's a lot. That's one of the ones I'm excited about. A bunch of musicals.
You're starting to work on a lot of musicals now.
Oh my God. It's so funny because I hadn't really grown up. I was not a musical kid. I didn't do them in, you know, any part in my school, really. A very short solo in the musical Working in college, which my mother literally cackled out loud when I sang my three lines. I know. I was like, Mom, damn it. Anyway, so I did not have a great relationship with it. But seeing new musicals, especially contemporary musicals, and really learning how beautiful it was. But what's interesting was I'd written plays that always have a ton of heart. I don't want to see a play where the emotion is off stage. I want to see it center stage. That's what I'm doing there. How do you live this life? How do you confront sorrow and betrayal and joy? I just want to see it. That's what I want. Well, that's what musicals are. Yep. Man, they're like, we cannot have enough emotions. So in some ways, it makes total sense that what I've been fighting so hard for in straight theater, it makes me a perfect candidate for writing musicals. So there's a musical, Jeanette, which we just did at the O'Neill about America's first congressperson, female congressperson, which nobody knows who she is. Yeah. That's with Ariane Afsar, who is an amazing musical theater talent, composer and lyricist as well, and a London musical and a new musical. Musicals galore.
Right. Is there a play of yours that you wish would get more done more often, or that you wish more people had seen, had a chance to see?
That's such a good question. I think it's the first one I mentioned, Exit Pursued by a Bear.
Okay.
I think it is a wild comedy.
Does it have any relation to Shakespeare? Yeah. That is the line from Winter's Tale.
Indeed.
It's a stage direction.
It is indeed, It is a play about stage directions, really, which sounds like, well, that sounds boring as hell.
That noises off.
Yeah, right, exactly. And they're both really funny, right? And that's what I think what this play does. And I want plays that do things. And this play is one that, through wild comedy, tackles domestic violence in a way that, like, people don't understand why I'm laughing so hard at this thing that is so serious. But what comedy does is it unites an audience. It makes you aware of the people around you, which builds a community. And you lean in to a story instead of lean away, which some drama can force you to flinch and, you know, literally want to leave. And comedy is like, stay, it's great, the water's warm, come on in. And it's Southern, and I'm Southern, and it's a play about something that I think really matters. It's a play that ends kind of defiantly, joyfully. A play about friendship, and so I think it's kind of an odd play. Aesthetically, people, I don't know if they would know that I wrote it. You know what I mean? They're going to go, oh, it's not about science, and it's not women wearing skirts and corsets, and it's this kind of ferocious, you know, comedy, so.
Is there a wild idea that you have that you hadn't had a chance to write yet, or that you haven't found an opportunity for yet? Yeah.
Oh man, so many of them. Always. Yeah. I mean, I'm at this point in my career where I will say, with as much confidence as my, you know, Southern humbleness will allow me, but I know how to write a play now. Mm. And so, what is the thing that scares me? What is the thing to do next? What is the thing to do with the form that I don't know if it's going to work?
Right.
I mean, I love writing every play. I love the discoveries and the journey of it. But what is something that I can do now at my point in my career where I can kind of tear it apart and mess with it and see if we can make something new? So that is one play that I'm working on that is a commission does that. Mm. And I'm a bit terrified of it. And it kind of makes me want to do more. So I think there's a couple new ideas that I want to play with my own comfort zones, which I think every artist gets to that point where that's where they know that they're learning, ready to shift and change and challenge.
Well, we- we look forward to seeing those when they happen. And happy opening tonight. I'm talking to you just before the opening of Half-Life and Ring of Fury. So congratulations.
Thank
happy opening.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to talk.
Thanks, Lauren.
That was Lauren Gunderson, the writer of The Half-Life of Marie Curie, now playing at Off-Broadway's Minetta Lane Theater, and the author of shows that will be seen around the country this year, including Miss Bennett, Christmas at Pemberley, I and You, Book of Will, Natural Shocks, and Exit, Pursued by a Bear. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, I'd really appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Or tell a fellow theater fan about us. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.